Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Good afternoon. Yeah, we made it to Wednesday. Firing up midweek. I got some fun stuff to start off. So for all the listeners who can't stand listening to me but tune in every day, stay tuned in today. No, there's a lot of people like that. Oh, I get hate calls from people. Sometimes the same people will call every day for weeks to tell me how much they can't stand listening to my show and then to comment on what I said today and then how they're never going to listen again. And then they call back the next day and do the same thing. I don't know. People just love hating what they hear, I guess. But that's neither here nor there. I had a talk earlier, an interview with a guy named Neil Ferguson, who sometimes is on TV. He's a professor maybe out on the West Coast and used to be at Harvard. I don't know where he went on the West Coast, but he's and I think he's Irish or British from where he started out in life, but is American now. Anyway, he's a fascinating guy, an historian who engages in great debates on TV. He's a real intellectual and one of the smartest guys around. So it was fun to interview him and test my theories against him and see if we're in agreement, which we are, which I find very encouraging because it means that the great intellectuals of the world are at least running right there with me. And I appreciate them. I appreciate them for doing that. Anyway, so I wanted to start off playing this Neil Ferguson stuff. Neil, N-I-A-L-L. I guess that's the Irish way of spelling it. We had a great debate here whether it's Niall or Neil. Turns out it's Neil. Anyway, I will interrupt at times to do commentary, but let me play this for you right now. Neil Ferguson is here. His new book is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Why the politics of catastrophe? Is that the larger context of where we are? Or is every day the politics of catastrophe, or is that just a reaction to the last year?
It's not just a reaction to last year. I wanted to write a general history of disaster for a while. I was fascinated by our strange relationship to disaster, because we're kind of, at one and the same time, fascinated by it. We love watching disaster movies, and we love science fiction in which the world has an apocalypse and a few survivors sort of stagger around. But at the same time, when a real disaster happens, we're at some level in denial about it. So I was fascinated by this phenomenon, and then along comes a disaster in the nick of time to give me a peg for the book. So the book is mostly about all the disasters you can think of, and I played a game with myself. Was if it, can you think of a disaster that isn't there? Vesuvius, it's in there. Titanic, there. Chernobyl, tick. And some great military disasters too. Because I think disasters have certain common features, and it's not enough just to say, well, what can we learn from past pandemics? You know, that's not enough. We have to recognize that whether it's an earthquake or a financial crisis or a war or a pandemic, that disasters have certain common features, and also that we got less good at dealing with them in recent years, and that was a particular motivation for writing the book even before this disaster is over. Because I think
wait a sec about on that. What in what way have we gotten worse at disasters?
Well, I think if you compare this pandemic with a comparably large pandemic, 1957-58, when the Asian flu killed about the same proportion of the world's population as COVID has so far. I mean, COVID may turn out to be worse in the end, but not massively worse. The U.S. response to that was completely different. There was no attempt to lock down the economy. There were no closures of schools. There was no state of emergency. People recognized that there was a new virus on the loose, and they were justly worried about it because it was killing young people as well as older people. But there was a recognition that the priority was get a vaccine as fast as possible and minimize the disruption otherwise. So when you look back on 57-58, it doesn't actually seem like that big a disaster, even though, as I said, globally, it was comparably large. And I think when you look at how we've handled this, we could have done so much better. Look at how Taiwan or South Korea handled it. They hear there's some new virus in Wuhan, China. They disbelieve the Chinese claim that there's no human-to-human transmission because they're Taiwan and South Korea, and they know not to believe what Beijing says. They ramp up testing extremely quickly because it was easy enough to design tests for this new virus. Then they have a system of contact tracing, and then they isolate the people who think they are infected or they think they're infected. And this works so that in Taiwan, 12 people have died of COVID, not 12,000, 12. We completely failed to do any of that, and I can't think of a good reason why.
So this is interesting, what he's laying out, Neil Ferguson. His new book is called Doom. It's a study of catastrophes and how the world responds to them, written over the past year during COVID. And what he's getting to is that we're not very good at things. We're not good at all at responding to an emergency like this. And I think what it comes down to, you'll hear us discuss this, is that we can't do what we're not practiced at. If we haven't been exercising certain muscles, humans just aren't good at using them. And we have systems which I think are totally broken. Forget about they haven't gotten exercise, but the bones won't hold up the body in order to be able to execute something as complex as how do you get our various governments all coordinated and all driving in a good direction on how to respond to something like what just transpired. And this has particular resonance, I think, with regard to Jolly Ned and how bad it is to have a completely incompetent, disinterested governor, you know, a guy who doesn't want to lead. He just wants to figure out what the angles are in order to deflect the rays of light that might point in his direction and illuminate just what he's failed to do. Like, this guy is an expert at interfering with the light hitting the trouble. Apparently, that's how he spent his life, and he gained an expertise in his life. But he has no expertise regarding leadership. And I think what Neil Ferguson drives at here in our conversation adds value to that conversation. Once again, Neil's book is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Back to the interview.
Because it's not like we don't have the capacity to test for a new virus. It's not like we don't have the capacity to have a contact tracing app on people's phones. It's not like we're incapable of taking infected people and isolating them, but we just chose not to do those things. We chose to do nothing, in fact, in January and February and the first half of March. And then we realized, oh dear, we've allowed this virus to spread throughout the country. Let's do what the Chinese did. Let's lock everything down. And this was an incredibly blunt instrument to use for this particular virus. And I think the unintended costs of those lockdowns will be with us for a long time. So
if you think about that, what he just said about the blunt instrument, this is what Ned did. When the blunt instrument was needed, that was at the beginning of this when the nursing homes were vulnerable. And if he'd had any instinct for leadership and it was driven by compassion at all, so that something inside of him would say, these people are in danger, I have to save them. Some little remains of imagination that might live inside of him could have been triggered and he might have been mobilized into trying to save those lives, because half of the deaths in the state of Connecticut still are from nursing home deaths. And think about that tragedy and the tragic lack of imagination in people in leadership positions. The inability to think, the inability to bring together smart people and have honest conversations, the disinterest in acting that Ned had to be in possession of in order to allow things to go as horribly as they did in the state. And then think about what comes next in the context of how it's possible that there are people in the state who actually buy the happy demeanor as a sign that Ned somehow handled the virus in a capable way.
So looking at the response, you can't give a high grade to the U.S. response. And I think we need to start figuring out why that happened, because it's too simple, way, way too simple to say, as many people do today, well, it was all President Trump's fault.
Yeah, well, some portion of it was surely the fault of the White House. Some was surely the fault of our big disease bureaucracies in Washington. And then the fact that we've got these 50 states that want to take their own approach, but none of them really took their own approach. They seem to all be looking for signals from Washington on what to do, as if leadership has just been squeezed out of them as a species, the governors. What is your take on that? Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think we need to recognize that it wasn't entirely Trump's fault. He made many mistakes, and I identify those in the later part of the book. But if we tell ourselves that a different president would have avoided 500,000 deaths if Joe Biden had magically been elected a year early, I think we're just deluding ourselves. Because, as you rightly say, there were failures at multiple levels. The CDC's failure to make testing available was a really major disaster, mm-hmm. because it meant that we were flying blind when other countries were figuring out who was infected. The state governor in New York, Mr. Cuomo, handled it dreadfully. He was more interested in getting PR opportunities for his planned presidential run.
All right, I'm going to interrupt here so we can get a break. And Neil Ferguson is the interview. We talked to him a couple of hours ago. His book is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. More coming up after this break on WTIC.
WTIC News Talk 1080 is on Instagram. Follow us at WTIC 1080.
All right. Back to the discussion. The politics of catastrophe with Neil Ferguson. This is fun stuff. I like Neil.
Than in actually protecting the elderly people in the...
Let me back it up a little bit so we get some continuity here.
PR opportunities for his planned presidential run than in actually protecting the elderly people in the care homes in New York. And so there were any number of agencies that failed. Actually, we have or had an undersecretary for preparedness whose one job this was, a guy named Cadleck. And it's interesting to discover that Robert Cadleck knew that our pandemic preparedness was inadequate. He gave a lecture, which I came across, in 2018, where he said, if there actually is a pandemic, we'll probably be SOL. And being British, I had to look up what SOL means, but you will know that it's bleep out of luck. And so the guy whose one job it was kind of knew that we were going to fall apart if there was a pandemic. But
this is our condition, is it not? We're talking to Neil Ferguson. His new book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. This, to me, is where America is at today. That is the real problem, that there is no framework for leadership anymore, that people don't bother leading anymore, that the pursuit of power is so all-consuming and so the only priority that there doesn't seem to be a department for how do we actually respond on a policy level and do a good job of it.
I think what we got is a very unwieldy bureaucratic administrative state which thinks that preparedness consists of writing a 36-page preparedness plan with accompanying PowerPoint deck, and then the job is done and you go home. And this is something that is not peculiar to public health. we have seen already back in 2008 that you can have pages and pages of financial regulation and still have a huge financial crisis. My sense is that part of our problem is the way the bureaucratic mindset functions, which is to say that you sit there looking at the risks. You don't really attach probabilities. You just think about risks. And then you draw up an elaborate document that appears to cover your ass for multiple scenarios. But it doesn't really address the problem of what will happen when the rubber hits the road. Meanwhile, the people who are in elected office are obsessively playing to the gallery, whether it's on TV or on social media. And in the middle, there isn't really anybody taking the kind of decisions that needed to be taken, particularly in the early stage of the pandemic. I mean, there's an interesting new report that just came out today that I was just glancing at, which is the first independent panel to do a kind of retrospective on the pandemic. And I'm very struck by the similarity between some of the findings there and some of the things I say in the book. You know, you got to be quick on the draw when disaster strikes. You got to turn on the dime. You can't predict the disaster. Nobody had any way of knowing when exactly the next big pandemic would happen, just as we don't know when the next big earthquake will strike California. But we just know it'll happen at some point. So the key is you've got to be quick when it starts. And the Taiwanese were that, and so were the South Koreans. And why was that?
But they had the advantage of fresh experience, didn't they? And aren't humans just woefully bad at doing things they haven't practiced? And doesn't that get magnified in a big bureaucratic state where nobody wants to make decisions? I mean, bureaucracies are the business of avoiding responsibility, aren't they?
Absolutely. Let's have a committee and pass the decision to the committee. I think that it's true that the Taiwanese and the South Koreans had thought a lot about SARS, and we had not really thought through what the lessons of SARS and MERS were. These were the first coronaviruses that really started to kill people. And they had thought about this, and I think we had failed to learn those lessons. But it's more than that. I think if you're South Korea or Taiwan or Israel, for that matter, you are generally paranoid because you know that the guys next door are out to get you. But you don't know quite how they're going to come at you. I mean, I was in Taiwan just before the pandemic. And what struck me was that they're kind of like, is it going to be an invasion? Will it be a cyber attack? Could it be biological? They're very, very ready for anything. They have a paranoid mindset, and that's healthy. And I kind of have come to the conclusion that it's better to be generally paranoid than to be meticulously prepared for the wrong disaster. So we need to change the culture in our bureaucracy to make it much more rapid reaction and much less 36-page pandemic preparedness plan plus PowerPoint deck.
All right, there's more of the Neil Ferguson interview that we'll play in the next half hour, but I just want you to think about this, because my take on what he's saying is, which is, again, the context, what if we had it to do over again? What if there's another one coming down the pike? What we can see here is that, especially in Connecticut, everything was done wrong. And it was done wrong because nobody tried to do it right. They were driven by fear. They took directives from Washington. And taking directives from a central government is a dangerous, scary thing. But to be fair, a pandemic can, all of the tragedy can be done in the first few minutes. If you don't take it seriously enough and you don't make the right calls, and how do you make the right calls before you have data, before you have information, and before you understand exactly what's coming down the pike? Well, first you try. That would be good. Had Jolly Ned tried and others tried, like Governor Cuomo in New York, they would have focused on protecting seniors in nursing homes instead of ignoring them, which is what they did. Funny that Ned is now calling in the National Guard to the nursing home to help with a strike, but he didn't do that to help with an attack of a deadly pandemic on the same premises. We'll talk more about it coming up after news. Stay with us on WTIC. WTIC Wednesday afternoon. So just before we came on the air, I recorded an interview with Neil Ferguson, author of a new book called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. And he's making the argument that we're not prepared to deal with catastrophes in this country, as demonstrated during COVID, because we have a big bureaucratic state that doesn't react. And there needs to be proper plans put in place, realistic ones, not just bureaucrats writing 36-page reports on what to do when tragedy strikes, but to do some further preparation. And my point to him is that's certainly true, that we do have this bloated bureaucratic approach to government now. We just dump money and throw money at problems, and money doesn't solve problems, and attempts to solve problems don't solve problems, and wishes to solve problems, that doesn't solve problems. It's actually trying to solve problems and having the teams in place with the experience necessary and the ability to execute and a unified political commitment to a plan to do that. And that's a complicated thing. And I make the point to him where we pick up back into the interview now that really it isn't just the problem that the bureaucracy didn't approach it right. The problem is that we're crippled by our current political state of affairs. Do you see any signs that we have that ability? Because I feel like we're talking about a problem living inside a larger political problem, and that is the reality of where America is today, that we've reached some big, blobbish, morbidly obese condition where the idea of us making an astute move is beyond our physical abilities and beyond our mental abilities. We're just not, I mean, if you think about us after World War II and what we and our allies had the ability to execute, we could execute stuff. What can we execute now? We have no even when we fight wars, we just send people over there and let disaster ensue for years, spending billions of dollars without a thought. There's nothing we do well, is there?
Well, that's part of the motivation for writing this book, because I've been thinking about this problem really for a long time. I wrote a book called Colossus back in 2003, realizing that it was all going to go wrong in Iraq. I wrote a book called The Great Degeneration 10 years ago, saying there's something really badly wrong with the way we are running this country. And I think I've come to the conclusion that it is fixable, because you find little pockets of incredible creativity in America. Now, let's remember, when I was writing and finishing Doom, I didn't know if the vaccines were going to work, because by the time I went to press, we didn't have the phase 3 trials. But my hunch was that our vaccines would be better than the Chinese vaccines, and not just a bit better. And that was right. Here, the heroes are, in many ways, those people at companies like Moderna and the German company mm-hmm. BioNTech, who took mRNA technology and they made it something that is truly extraordinary, with 90% plus efficacy. So there is hope, because we are still, despite our unwieldy government system, we are still able to be astonishingly creative. We've also fixed things in the past. If you remember, the military after Vietnam was demoralized. There was a general feeling that it sucked. Public trust was at an extremely low level. And the military kind of did a great job of fixing itself. Admittedly, as you said, it was then put to a questionable use. But you couldn't deny that the effectiveness of the military in their initial efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think ultimately failure there was political, not military. So I do think we're capable of fixing ourselves, but not until we recognize the true nature of the problem, that we have this kludgeocracy, a word I don't particularly like, but it kind of captures it. Of
what is that word?
Kludgeocracy. I came across this when I was asking myself the question, does anybody else realize that there's something quite wrong with the way the government works? And I found that there were kindred spirits out there, like Frank Fukuyama, and then Mark Andreessen, the tech guy here in Silicon Valley. And they're all kind of coming at the same point, albeit from slightly different angles. And the word kludgeocracy crossed my radar, capturing this curious way in which the bureaucracy can give you the impression that it has a problem covered by writing long reports and having the PowerPoint decks, but it's not. And And we have this in our system, and it's not confined to government, because I think there's kludgeocracy in some of our big corporations. There sure is kludgeocracy in some of our universities. It sort of spreads outward. So I think we can fix this. I think we've got a good track record. We're not condemned as Americans to be like this. Actually, we didn't used to be like this at all. As you rightly say, go back to the 1950s, the post-45 generation were very, very good at fixing things. They were very quick on the draw. Think how quickly they reacted to the invasion of South Korea. The Truman administration was definitely not ready for that. It was caught off balance, but the response was extremely swift, and it ultimately succeeded in driving the North Koreans back across the border. So I think we can learn from history how to be quicker on the draw, how to turn on a dime, and we can learn from our own history because we used to be good at that.
So that's my interview with Neil Ferguson earlier today. He's on a book tour, so they only give you 15 minutes with the authors on these high-level book tours, you know, where they just pound out one interview. They put them in a room, and they have them just go from one station to the next all day in 15-minute increments. But it was a fun conversation. His new book is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, and that's where I feel like we are, that we don't know how to do things anymore. We don't have the ability. We don't have even the wish, the desire on the part of our elected leaders. And I don't know about the bureaucrats who work behind them, but our elected officials don't pursue anything but their own best interests. And until we can fix that, until we can somehow require of them that they desire the best for the country or the state or whatever they're running, I don't know what we do. And this idea that you can throw money at things, we hear these arguments all the time. We need more money, as if more money is going to fix anything. We're spending fortunes compared to what we have ever spent. 860-522-9842. Or you can take a few phone calls if anybody wants to discuss. 860-522-9842. And I've got other clips of other people I want to play for you as well on a similar subject, you know, this general subject. George calling from St. Louis. Hi, George.
Hi, Todd. You're talking, or he is talking about the effects of a big bloated centralized government. These are all the effects of just that. And you have to realize something, that Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire, even Hitler, trying to all form these empires don't work. They never have in the past. But China right now is trying to build an empire, and it doesn't work. Look at the effects of the empire that Biden has been building. The extra $6 trillion deficit added to a $30 trillion deficit, and the worker shortage, the government paying unemployment and the worker shortage as a result of that, the border crisis. But look at recently. Look at the Columbia pipeline hack. This government couldn't handle that hack. They can't protect the country.
They're not able to deliver what a government is supposed to do because there is no cause and effect other than their own political best interests. And the purpose of the spending of money is, like, what's going on right now with Biden is abhorrent. It's the most appalling politics you could ever imagine. Simply passing spending bills with no particular purpose for the money except for it to be sitting in a pot so they can hand it out to their friends whenever they feel like to help them win elections.
Exactly. The only reason for an infrastructure bill is to do just that, handle monies out to the engineering companies and the infrastructure companies that are their buddies that they contribute to their political funds.
Yes, the unions, most of all, the special interest group that helps them more than any other win elections. George, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. 860-522-9842. The rant line number, don't forget we've got rants coming up in about an hour and 20 minutes. At 860-751-4690. We've got some good rants today. Oh, we do. It's fun when people get creative, and we have one or two of those today as well. Okay, now, along these same lines, a quick conversation with Michael Leibowitz. Michael Leibowitz is here from Cheshire. Is that your prison? No, Osborne.
My president is Osborne. You're confusing me with
yes.
the other guy.
I can't possibly do that. Leibowitz wants to talk to us about the beauty with which it's like watching orchestrated swimming or some kind of Olympic game to see how the prisons in the state of Connecticut are run.
Actually, what
is that
I
enough
want to
of
talk,
a setup?
Yeah, actually, I want to talk to you about the disservice that the prison unions, the prison guard union to be specific, is doing to the citizens of this state. So I guess I need to give you a little backdrop.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you can understand. So I think that most people can understand the frustration that they've been going through the last year with these lockdowns and, you know, restaurants are closed and places of business are closed and you got to wear a mask. And I'm sure that people are upset about that. And in prison here, it's been pretty much the same thing since March of 2020. The jail's been on lockdown, you know, on again, off again, on lockdown for the whole time. We haven't been going outside. We've missed work. We have to wear masks. So a lot of guys are pretty frustrated in here due to that. Now, also, last summer, even when we were on lockdown, I think it was on last Father's Day it started happening, where every week then we would be on lockdown because correctional officers were taking time off, and if they understaffed, if they go under a certain number, we have to be on lockdown. Also, during the last year, we had to move out of each unit. All the guys had to move out of their block to another block so the lights could get fixed. And then guys had to move out of the block that were sick so they can go to an isolation unit. And finally, when we got off lockdown, then we had the yearly institutional lockdown. So guys are pretty frustrated, but by and large, guys have managed it well. There's been some, you know, instances where guys were throwing stuff on the pier and stuff because they were angry. But for the most part, people understood that it was a pandemic and, you know, stringent measures were required. But now we're all vaccinated. Well, not all of us, but a large amount of us are vaccinated. And it's starting again now in the summertime where correctional officers are taking time off on the weekends and we end up locked down on the weekends.
This is a conversation with Michael Leibowitz, also recorded, that touches on some of the same issues that we discussed with Neil Ferguson. More of that coming up after we take a break right now on WTIC.
Want to have a little fun? Follow us on Instagram at WTIC 1080.
WTIC. 860-522-9842. All right, so we listened to Neil Ferguson, and this Michael Leibowitz interview is feeding into the same subject, really, that Neil Ferguson was talking about, and that is the disastrous condition of the machinery of politics and government in America today. Back to the Leibowitz discussion.
And guys are becoming very frustrated. For instance, this last Mother's Day.
Because there's no longer an excuse for it. It's just there and going on for no reason.
Yes. And we go outside once every 4 days, if that. And then the lockdown on the weekends with no shower, no phones. This Sunday guys couldn't call. They couldn't call their moms. And the thing is, what I want people to understand is I'm not asking anybody to feel sorry for the inmates or to say that the inmates don't deserve it or anything like that. That's irrelevant to what I'm saying. My point is that frustration mounts. You're not dealing with rational people to begin with, and it ends up putting other inmates at risk. It puts the staff here at risk. And most importantly, these guys are getting out, so it puts the community at risk. Now, where the teachers union, I mixed up my corrupt union, where the prison guard union is this. The other day, I asked the warden of this institution about this, and I explained to him what I just explained to you. And he said to me that, basically his hands are tied. If the count of correctional officers here goes under a certain number, we have to go on what's called a modified lockdown. And if it goes further down, we go on complete lockdown. And I asked him, is this a function of the unions? He said the guards are allowed a certain amount of days off. And I asked him, I said, well, isn't that amount of time off that they get negotiated by unions? And he said, oh, yeah. And he said, and also the amount of guards necessary for you guys to be able to come out was also negotiated by the unions. So not only do they say that we get X amount of days off, but they also say, well, if we're not there, you guys can't come out. And I just think it's a disservice to the taxpayers of the state who foot the bill, who ultimately somebody ends up getting hurt because you have frustrated guys who are in here being caged up for over a year and not learning how to function in society, and then you just let them out and say, well, here you go, and I think you know what happens next.
Well, it's also evidence for people, I think, to understand how the prison system works. That is that every, from what I have discerned, from what I've learned from you and Brent McCall and others, and that is that it exists to serve itself. The purpose of government hiring is in order to have people who work for the government, to create a big body of people who have relationship to those who hold power, so that there is a certain level of devotion that is based not on the quality of the leadership being provided, but on the special favors that are provided in that relationship. And the Department of Corrections, it seems to me, is the epitome of this system. That is the only... Let me just interrupt myself in this interview with Leibowitz, because I think this is the crux of what Neil Ferguson is really attacking and maybe doesn't want to get into, because it's a whole other book. And Ferguson's new book is about the politics of catastrophe. And he's trying to be hopeful and say there's a way for us to tackle it. But standing right behind the inability to respond to a catastrophe because we haven't prepared properly and we're too bureaucratic is the fact that we don't have a political system that is even trying to do the best thing for itself, for its voters, for its constituents, for the state, for the country, whatever it is, because they're too busy trying to get power for themselves. They're just grubby overeaters who want to grab every new bite of food and stuff it down their gullet before somebody else can. And that gluttony of where we are today, to me, that's the problem. And that's what we see in the performances of on the federal leadership and the state leadership. That's what is going on and is plainly in view if you gain yourself a little sophistication in watching it.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.